From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, in for April Bear. Today, a pro-business advocacy group says the insurrection and denial of election results will fundamentally change how they make political endorsements and contributions.
U.S. Chamber of Commerce said they are members of Congress, based on their behavior over the last 3 months, have lost the chamber's support, full stop.
Then acclaimed actor, musician Jeff Daniels joins us to talk about writing new songs in Michigan during the year of COVID.
It's been my answer, I'll tell you that. I've been more reclusive than J.D. Salinger. I am in a bunker and have been.
And former Detroit mayor and NBA legend Dave Bing's new memoir reflects on life's many obstacles and overcoming them.
I think we left the city in a much better position than we found it.
Those stories coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, in today for April Bear. Finding creativity during the pandemic can be hard, but it appears that hasn't stopped Michigan actor and musician Jeff Daniels. We'll speak to the Michigander about his latest album coming up later this hour. But first, arguably the most powerful pro-business advocacy group in the state, the Detroit Regional Chamber, says it's changing the way it handles political contributions in light of the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. Dozens of Republican lawmakers, including some from Michigan, voted in favor of rejecting election results. That's after that mob swarmed the Capitol building on January 6th. Now, it's common for pro-business groups to be supportive of pro-business Republican candidates. But now the head of the Detroit Regional Chamber says there's more to consider than just stances on taxes or strategic investment. So let's hear from him directly. Sandy Barua is the president and CEO of the Detroit Regional Chamber. Hey, Sandy.
Zoe, I'm delighted to be with you.
Hey, it's good to have you here. So you put out this statement about why the chamber is making this decision, and it reads, because of, quote, a grave concern that too many of our elected leaders not only did too little to thwart the violence at the Capitol, but propagated the falsehood that the 2020 election was not valid or somehow stolen. Tell me how you came to this decision.
So this is where the fine print is really important, Zoe. And the fine print in this case is that because of my commitment to the Federal Reserve Bank, where I serve on the board there, I am not allowed to be a member of our PAC. And so I was not part of the decision-making process. But however, since I am president of the Detroit Regional Chamber, where the PAC underneath it, I can talk at a fairly high level at about what the PAC members were thinking and why they issued this statement. So having had gone through that very important fine point that I wasn't part of the decision-making process, I will say that I do strongly support the actions that our PAC members took in this case here. You know, businesses value, as you said, Zoe, so well, you know, several things. It is not just about, you know, business policies. The most important business policy out there is the policy of stability. It's the policy of predictability. And the fact that we just went through a post-election period that many of our, you know, elected members of Congress and our elected legislators, people who swore an oath, you know, to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, to protect the American people from enemies within and without the country, that we had people who either played along with a falsehood, which was that this most recent election was somehow stolen or that there was fraud to any great degree. In fact, we know from Trump's own head of election security at the Homeland Security Department, Chris Krebs, that stated plainly and clearly this was the most secure and the election with the highest level of integrity in our country's history, that you had over 50 lawsuits that were filed on behalf of kind of the what I'm going to call the pro-Trump side, and all but one of them were either lost or summarily dismissed, and the one that was won was on a procedural issue that didn't change a single vote, that you had secretaries of state both Republicans, Democrats, governors, both Republicans and Democrats, stand up and say, you know, this vote was absolutely among the best. But the kicker is, Zoe, that, you know, one of the things that Republicans have always stood for, and as I think is famously known, I am a longtime Republican. I worked for two Republican presidents and grew up on Capitol Hill working for a senior member of the Republican Senate, that federalism, the idea that states have, you know, the ability to experiment, but most importantly, that we don't have national elections in the United States of America. We have 50 state elections. And it is the states that run elections. It's the states that certify the elections. And by the action of some, they were trying to nationalize the election. And that is a grave strike against federalism. And I know the PAC members were very concerned about that. And I certainly share that concern.
Well, so what does that mean then? Because, you know, you are concerned, the PAC members are concerned about pushing forward with this idea of election fraud. And yet folks that took the chamber's endorsement, I'm talking about a Republican Congressman Jack Bergman from the 1st District, for example, Tim Walberg, Republican from the 7th District, just to name a couple, Michigan Republicans who voted even after, as I said, that evening of the insurrection, voted saying some states they did not believe had accurate counts. Will you go back on these endorsements of these candidates?
Yeah. So again, you know, when you use the word we, I really want to be careful because I am not a member of the PAC and those decisions are up to the PAC. I do not expect the PAC to kind of go back and retroactively reevaluate endorsements that were made. I can say, however, with great certainty, you know, having talked to some of the PAC members, having consulted with Brad Williams, who's our chief staff person who kind of manages our PAC activities, that what the PAC members really intend is to be very thoughtful. And when they do go to make recommendations going forward for endorsements, how those members behaved in these last, you know, 3 months regarding kind of, you know, supporting, you know, essentially conspiracy theories, you know, how they voted, you know, to in support of federalism or not in support of federalism, you know, the language that they've used that may have, you know, furthered people's wrongly held beliefs that there's some, you know, Pizzagate conspiracy theory out there regarding the vote in Michigan or in other parts of the country. You know, that's going to weigh on their decision. Now, will that mean that those members who, you know, acted that way will never get an endorsement from the Detroit Regional Chamber? I cannot say that. And I would doubt that even the members of our PAC know the answer to that question. I just know that they consider this serious and they wanted to make a statement and go on the record because of it.
Do you think by putting this out this statement that you, and by you, I mean the PAC, will actually be able to possibly make some change and influence some folks as they decide whether they are going to continue to be outspoken in these lies?
Well, certainly the Detroit Regional Chamber PAC is by far not alone. I mean, you look at many of the national organizations that we have close relationships with. The National Association of Manufacturers came out, you know, the day of the sedition on the Capitol grounds. I mean, they were one of the leaders. Other business organizations, obviously, we're very close to the U.S. Chamber. I've been close to the U.S. Chamber for years, especially during my years in Washington. You know, they were very strong on this issue. But if you look at company after company, based here in Michigan, Fortune 500 companies like, you know, DTE and Ford Motor Company and others have all said either, hey, we are reevaluating, you know, how we do political endorsements. Some of them have even said that, you know, have said point blank. In fact, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce said they are members of Congress based on their behavior over the last 3 months have lost the chamber's support, full stop. And that is almost a direct quote from Neil Bradley, who's the chief political person and policy person at the U.S. Chamber.
Sandy, turning away from endorsements, I want to pick your brain. Former Michigan governor, a governor you know well, Jennifer Granholm, has, of course, been nominated to be the Secretary of Energy. How do you think she's going to do?
I think she's going to do well. I am not concerned that Jennifer Granholm is not going to be confirmed as our nation's next energy secretary. One, she knows politics well. Even though she's new to Washington, she's new to the Senate confirmation process, which, I went through it twice. It is not a picnic, but none of that's going to surprise her. And, even those who disagree with her politically and certainly during my time in Washington when she was governor and I was either leading the SBA or the Assistant Secretary at the Commerce Department, we certainly had our policy differences and certainly Jennifer Granholm liked beating up on my boss at the time, President Bush. People like Governor Granholm personally. I mean, she is a lovely person. She gets along well. And a lot of, a good deal of the Senate confirmation process is the relationship that you're able to develop with the members of the Senate as you go through what's called courtesy visits. And we know that, our friends Gary Peters and Debbie Stabenow are going to bend over backwards to ensure that Jennifer Granholm gets a warm welcome in Washington.
Finally, just a few hours ago, another governor of Michigan, current Governor Whitmer, announced a bipartisan commission that's meant to educate folks about the COVID-19 vaccine. One Sandy Baruha is part of this commission. What are you going to be doing exactly?
Well, our first meeting is on Friday, so I'm very much looking forward to that. Certainly, I'm delighted to be on this commission because the number one issue we face in Michigan is the same issue that we face in Washington and, frankly, globally, is that we've got to get needles in arms. I don't care if your first priority is public health. I don't care if your first priority is opening up the economy. I don't care what your priority is. But the elixir to any big challenge that we're facing right now in society, I would say political strife, frankly, is getting needles in arms.
Sandy Baruha is the president and CEO of the Detroit Regional Chamber. Sandy, we got to run, but we'll have you back maybe even when Jennifer Granholm is indeed in front of those Senate chairs.
Would love to, as always.
Still to come, we'll hear from former Detroit Mayor Dave Bing about his new memoir following his transition from the NBA to business and then to politics. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark in today for April Bear. Last week, the big news in Detroit was President Trump's 11th hour commutation of former Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick. Kilpatrick served more than 7 years of a 28-year sentence and was released to his family, who's living in Georgia. Kilpatrick's elected successor in office was former Detroit Pistons basketball player and successful businessman Dave Bing. Bing was charged, whether of course he liked it or not, with restoring faith in the office of mayor after a series of scandals and criminal charges that really nearly crippled the business of the city. April Bear spoke with former Detroit Mayor Dave Bing about being mayor and his time in the NBA after the release of his new book, Attacking the Rim, late last year. Here's their conversation.
Dave Bing, welcome to Stateside.
Well, thank you so very much. My pleasure to be with you.
In the book, you write about how when you first came to Detroit, you were this first-round draft pick making a good salary, one of the stars of the team already. There was a lot of anticipation. But you came to Detroit, and you went down with one of the front office guys to the First National Bank of Detroit and got turned down flat for a mortgage loan. It's an amazing anecdote about the times and so unthinkable by today's standards. And later on, one of the bank's executives came to you and apologized and offered to bring you into the bank with an entry-level job during the summertime. There are so many astonishing things about this story, but I wanted to ask you why you decided to go in, take the offer, and go to work at a place that had turned you down as a client.
You know, I'm one, I never hold things against people. You know, that was a corporate decision. And I understood, you know, big business had to make decisions. And they were not willing to take a risk. And they looked at me as a young guy just out of college with a family, wasn't from here, playing for, you know, one of the worst teams in the NBA, because the only reason I was drafted by the Pistons was because the Pistons and the Knicks were the worst two teams in the NBA. So the bank wanted to be safe. And, you know, I couldn't hold that against them. So as the season progressed, and I had a lot of success my rookie year.
So when Aubrey Lee, who was the vice president of NBD, called me to apologize, number one, and said they'd like to make amends for the decision that they made, and they would like to offer me a job by putting me into a training program. And I thought that was a good opportunity for me, because the decision wasn't about an individual. It was a corporate decision. And I accepted that as such, you know, trying to hold a grudge because you thought somebody may have done you wrong. It's just not part of my makeup. So I accepted his apology and also accepted the job. And I did that for 7 years, seven off seasons.
You have so many amazing stories in this book about your time with the Pistons and later in Washington during your NBA career. And I confess, I was behind on the lore. I didn't realize how many problems you were having with your eyesight all those years you were playing. And it was just astonishing to read about all this and realize at one point you were dealing with a detached retina. I mean, I think a lot of people just would not have known while you were playing that your eyesight was such a health problem for you. How did you manage during games?
You know, I guess basketball, like a lot of things, is all about repetition. Repetition and feel. And, you know, I knew how big the court was. I knew how high the basket was. I knew how far away from the basket the free throw line was. And so, you know, I just learned to make adjustments kind of on the fly. I never gave a second thought that because of my eyesight being what it was, that I would not be able to play. I mean, the fear was not with me at all until I had the detached retina in my good eye. That's when I was afraid, because all of a sudden I had learned to live my life, you know, with one eye. But when the good eye got hurt in an exhibition game is when I really started to worry about whether or not I'd be able to play again and whether or not I'd be able to see again. And so I was very fortunate that I had a great team of doctors who performed the operation. And the oldest doctor on that team basically said, you know, you probably shouldn't play again. I'm only 26 years old at the time, and I'm at the top of my game. And to hear the senior doctor say, you know, it's a big risk. And if you get hurt again, if that eye gets hurt again, you might not be able to see. So that was fear, and I knew the risk that was attached to that, but I never gave a second thought that if I could see, I'm going to play. And that's it. And I played another 8 years with that detached retina. The operation was successful.
You had already had this very full and very successful NBA career and reinvented yourself as the CEO in the steel industry when you decided to run for mayor. The city was in this moment when Kwame Kilpatrick's tenure was just falling apart. You had done so many things in your life already, but how did you know that you were ready to get into this very rough and tumble free-for-all that is Detroit city politics and city government?
The reality is I knew I wasn't ready. And so I therefore had to make a very, very hard decision. I knew what a precarious situation the city was in. I knew the things that Kwame had done, because I had been very supportive of him. And as these things started to unravel, it was obvious to me that we needed more leadership in city government. And I never gave myself early on the thought that I was the one that would become the next mayor. So there was a lot of discussion I was having with a core group of friends and business associates who over time convinced me that I was the right guy at the right time to do this. I had built up a really good relationship with a lot of people in the city, in this area, prior to thinking about politics. And the big risk for me was with all of the support that I had over time, you go into politics, which is a tough, different kind of business, that you're lucky if 51% of the people support you. So all the goodwill that I had achieved and built up over my years in Detroit was at risk. But I said, you know, it's worth taking this risk because the city is bigger than me. The need for the city and its residents are bigger than me. So I made the decision without any political background, without a lot of knowledge in terms of government. So I had to really learn quick. And a lot of it was on the job, which made it that much more difficult.
If you're just joining us, my guest is former Detroit mayor and NBA All-Star great Dave Bing. He has a new memoir called Attacking the Rim, My Journey from NBA Legend to Business Leader to Big City Mayor to Mentor. You write in the book about the many, many difficult moments that you had to face as mayor, culminating with the city's bankruptcy and the entree of Kevin Orr as the city's emergency manager. It was a very catalytic and hard time in Detroit. I wonder if the experiences that you got during that time, knowing what you now know about the city, and I guess how the state of Michigan works too, has this changed how you think about what it takes to move the needle on some of the really big issues? I'm thinking about stuff like the water shutoffs and foreclosure problems that Detroit has dealt with in recent years under Mayor Duggan, or maybe just about the city's chronic revenue problem, which has continued even after the bankruptcy?
A lot of the things that I had to deal with are still being confronted by Mayor Duggan and his administration. When you are in that much debt, and I think Kevin Orr and his team did a very credible job because we were $18 billion in debt and long-term liabilities. The pension and health care was killing the city. You know, we had 54 unions that you had to deal with, and all of them were trying to protect their people, their employees. And even though I think Kevin did an outstanding job by eliminating about $7 billion of debt off the balance sheet, you know, the city is still left with $11 billion of debt and long-term liability to go forward. And because the tax revenue in the city is so important to generate the money that you need to run this city, you still have a lot of people who are either unemployed or underemployed and don't add a lot to the tax base, but yet depend on all of those city services. So I think Mayor Duggan and his administration came in, they had a much better balance sheet than I had to deal with, but they still got some problems going forward because, you know, we're not a destination city where you got a lot of people who want to move into the city. I mean, you have a city that had 1.5 million people at one time, and now you're roughly around 700,000 people. So you've lost over half of your population. And most of those people that left were your middle class people where you were getting tax revenues from. So I think we still got some major problems that we've got to deal with. They just don't go away easy.
It's so crazy to me that you were such a success in the NBA, such a success in your business career. Bing Holdings did well. And yet, when you came to City Hall, you were the guy that people looked to after the Kilpatrick administration to bring back some order. What was it like being seen as that person who needed to play cleanup?
Well, it was a major challenge, no doubt in my mind about it. But, you know, the thing that was rewarding to me is before I went into City Hall, I, like so many other people, thought that a lot of city employees were only there for a paycheck. And when I came in and got to meet, especially city department directors, and then some people on down in the organization, it became very apparent that people were there because they loved the city and they wanted to see the city rebound. It made me feel emboldened that what I was doing was very dependent upon the people in the administration, the leadership. I was very fortunate that we didn't lose any of our top leaders, department heads. They stayed with me because they saw me as a guy who was trying to do the right thing, not trying to come in and make money. And a guy that would come to work every day and get down in the trenches with them and tell them the truth, let them know exactly where we were and the things that I thought we had to do. So there were no easy decisions. I mean, almost every major decision that I had to make was a negative impact on a lot of people here in the city. And so it was easy for people to turn against you. But we had to do what we had to do. I understood it. They understood it. And we stayed in the trenches and made it happen. And I think as we finished my term, I think we left the city in a much better position than we found it and made it much more possible for the Duggan administration to hit the ground running.
I got the sense reading the book that you really haven't had a lot of time to be able to enjoy Detroit. I mean, when you first came to town, it's true you were part of the Pistons and very much a known figure, but you know, you had a young family. You had a lot going on, obviously, during the years when you went into business and when you were involved in politics, it was just nonstop. Have you been able to enjoy the city much in the past couple of years?
What I do enjoy about the city are its people. I've established an unbelievable amount of friendships that dates all the way back to when I first came into the city. And outside of family, those friendships mean a lot to me. So I had a lot of my friends that were worried about me and thought I was going nuts when I said, yeah, I'll run for mayor. But they stuck with me and they're with me today. And that's what I value. I've not had a lot of time to enjoy the city, because you're always going from crisis to crisis. So there's a lot of work to be done. But when you step away from it for a moment and say, did I make a difference? Did we make a difference? The answer is absolutely yes, because I think if I had not made the decision to go into that position, we probably would have gone into bankruptcy quicker. A lot of people would have gotten hurt even worse than they did. And so I've never worried about trying to have a good time. The good time for me is to see people other than myself. I've been blessed, but to see other people lesser than me have a chance for a good life. And that's what I focus on, even today with the program that I started with young boys.
This mentoring program that you do write about in the book, what are you telling these young men about what they see around them right now? Massive, massive casualties due to COVID, a huge economic crisis, worse even than the one that you had to face down as mayor. What are you saying to them about this moment?
We are doing some things now with these young boys that I think will change their lives. So many people, because you're young, because you're Black, because you're poor, because you, in some cases, have an urban education, all of those things are deemed to be a negative for these boys. And so they never have somebody in their lives that are telling them, in spite of all of those negatives, you still can be a success. And the success comes from making sure there are role models, male role models in these boys' lives. So as I talk to them, I let them know what I went through personally. And, you know, they may not have the same opportunities that I have because of my athletic ability and then the good education that I got from public schools. But trying to really be a positive impact on the way they think and the way they see things is very, very important. You want them to understand that their dreams can come true and become a reality. But we tell them how to prepare for both the negatives and the positives, and really focus on the positives, because there are just too many negatives that it's easy to say, I quit, I can't do this. And we want to make sure that we don't let them quit. When I look back at the boys who came in our program initially as ninth graders, now as seventh graders, we have a much longer tenure with them. And so our mentors have done an unbelievably significant job, because they have stayed with these boys, in some cases from the ninth grade through graduation. And we have 100% graduation rate for all of our boys that have entered our program, which is kind of unbelievable.
Dave Bing's new book is Attacking the Rim: My Journey from NBA Legend to Business Leader to Big City Mayor to Mentor. Mayor, it's great to hear your voice. Stay safe, and thank you for talking to us.
Well, thank you so very much, and you all stay safe also.
That was April Baer speaking with former Detroit Mayor Dave Bing. Still to come, do you wake up every morning of the pandemic wondering just what Jeff Daniels is up to? Okay, you probably don't, but our next guest just might. That's because we're going to speak to actor and musician Jeff Daniels and see how he is holding up through the pandemic. That's coming up on Stateside. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark in for April Baer. Michigan's favorite son is back, and he's trying to keep things interesting. During the past year of COVID, Jeff Daniels, of course, the acclaimed actor and playwright and musician, has found a way to stay busy. He starred in the Showtime series The Comey Rules last fall, playing former FBI director James Comey. He's come out with a new album called Alive and Well Enough, and he's holding a series of concerts, including one coming up this Friday at the Midland Center for the Arts. Jeff Daniels, welcome back to Stateside.
Nice to be here.
So I don't know about you, but I feel like everyone asks each other during the pandemic how they're doing, and no one really knows what to say. You know, like you say, oh, I'm okay, or I'm holding up. And then I heard the title of your album, Alive and Well Enough, and I sort of thought that's the answer to how are you holding up.
It's been my answer, I'll tell you that. I've been more reclusive than J.D. Salinger. I am in a bunker and have been. And, you know, staying safe. And now we got new variants, and maybe you're getting a vaccine, maybe you're not. Depends on the day, which way the wind's blowing. I mean, we're still in the middle of it. So I'm alive and well enough kind of says it all.
And so that really has been sort of your response to this.
Yeah, many of us take it seriously, and this is what we have to do is stay inside, stay away from people as much as we can, try to stop the spread of this thing, try to get on the other side of it. I wish we were doing better. I wish we were all taking it seriously. I don't know what it's going to take for some people to take it seriously, but in the meantime, I am. So, you know, stay away from me.
And you've been writing this out in Michigan, yeah?
Yeah, I've been home. I was getting ready to shoot something in Pennsylvania, and we were literally down there for 2 days, and they said, go home. You'll probably be back in 2 weeks, but go home. And it will have been a year. I go down again in a month, and we start again in the midst of all this, but with protocols and masks and vaccines. So at least we got a chance of, staying safe. It's actually on the movie set. We just went through a COVID primer with the infectious guys that are running this thing, and they're big time guys. So they're basically saying, if you're going to get infected, it'll be in your hotel or where your rental house, versus at the workplace. It's pretty tight. So I feel confident.
So you're in Michigan. What has it been like? I mean, you are a political observer, and then, you know, you take what you see and you put it into your acting and your music. What has it been like to see your state, Michigan, over the past year? I'm thinking whether it be guns at the Capitol back in April, a governor, you know, and this FBI and this hostage situation. You know, what has that been like to watch your state go through?
Well, we've always been a swing state for a reason. We're not one or the other. We're both. And we live next to each other. But that was when we could talk to each other. That was when Tip O'Neill and Ron Reagan could sit in a room and work something out. That was when Boehner and Obama almost did. And that's not the case anymore. And I look at it more as the Republican Party having to decide whether it wants to continue as one thing or the other deal with it. I think it's an in-house internal problem right now inside the Republican Party. You could see it coming as soon as Trump took over. And now guys like Rob Portman, who just said, I'm not coming back after 2022. Other guys, Jeff Flake, Bob Corker, others have just said, this is going in a direction I don't understand. And I think Mitch McConnell and Kevin McCarthy and Liz Cheney and Josh Hawley, they all got to sit in a room and figure it out, because it's not going to continue the way it is. It just won't. And I think there are a lot of Republicans that have to decide if they want to stay on this bandwagon or not. You know, so it's not just about your tax cuts anymore, folks.
And you're taking some of that thoughts. And I mean, you're turning it into these themes. And one of the songs I want you to tell me a little bit about is Come a Little Closer, speaking of. And that was written, in November 2016, right after Trump won?
A couple days after he won. It was a buckle up song. You could see it coming. This is what it's come to. And then who knew? Who knew what would happen over the course of those 4 years leading up to January 6th?
Once upon a time, long ago, poor old I believed got the old heave ho. Remember to remember the Alamo. Come a little closer to me. The apocalypse is coming, sorry, gotta run. The odds on tomorrow now are 2-1. Someone just said something about a setting sun. Come a little closer to me. Old man river, have mercy on me. The devil's at the bottom of the deep blue sea. As Clark Gable said to Vivian Lee, come a little closer to me.
Yeah, the album deals with a lot of that. Certainly Come a Little Closer to Me opens that. Trumpty Dumpty Blues is on there. That was me writing in April, a month into the pandemic, when he got on television and invited us all to attend Easter service with him. I just couldn't take it anymore. And I Am America is a song that I co-wrote with Thornetta Davis that deals with the not only post George Floyd, but post Trayvon Martin, post Michael Brown, post Breonna Taylor. I mean, on and on and on and on. And then you read Isabel Wilkerson's book, Cast, and you go, this is 400 years. This is 400 years. And I think that's what's going on right now. We are dealing with or confronting, maybe once and for all, systemic racism. We'll see how we do.
Let me live. Let me breathe. Let me be who I want to be, where I want to be it. Let me be free. I was born right here, so this is my land too. And I will fight for my rights like I was raised to do. 'Cause I am America.
You co-wrote the song, as you said, I Am America, with just Detroit's beloved blues singer, Thornetta Davis. How'd that song, how did that come to be? Were you in Michigan? I mean, how does this work for musicians? You just call up your friends and go, man, this is intense. Let's jam. Give me some background.
I wrote it for now. to kind of as a song of unity, as a song of no, everyone has worth. As human beings, we're really all just one human being on one planet. That's where it kind of comes from. And then I wanted Thornetta, and I sent it to her, and I said, anything you don't like, change. Mm-hmm. And so everything she sings on the song, she wrote. And we had her come out to Chelsea, and it's just a statement as, you know, we can be a new America. We really can. We have far less to fear from each other than some people think. We can be better by being inclusive. We can be smarter. We can truly be the greatest country in the world, as Will McAvoy argued, if we deal with things like this. And I Am America gives value to everyone who is walking in this country. And so that's kind of where it came from. And then Thornetta took it over and turned it into like a prayer. It really becomes her prayer of, please, all I ask of you is to give me my freedom. That's all I ask.
It's time for peace. There's no time for hate. We must stop all this fighting before it's too late.
Give me your tire.
I am tired.
Give me your pour.
But I am strong.
Give me your hand.
I'll be here.
And I will guide you.
'Cause I know I belong.
Shore. I will rise up. I will rejoice.
Am America.
When you can hear my American voice.
Oh, yes. Give me my freedom. Give me my freedom. Give me my freedom. And I will rejoice.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with acclaimed actor, playwright, musician, and Michigander, Jeff Daniels. He's got a new album out titled Alive and Well Enough. Jeff, you've been doing these virtual concerts. You have one coming up this Friday at the Midland Center for the Arts. What's it like performing virtually, right? Like, I'm thinking of you in front of these huge audiences, whether it's Broadway or, you know, seeing you play at the Michigan Theater, and you have these humans feeding back what you're putting out there. You don't have that with these more intimate concerts. What's that been like as an artist?
It took a little bit, not a long time, a little bit of time to figure out, because I've done so many movies and TV. I mean, it's like working in front of a camera. The difference is you're looking right down the barrel of the lens. You're talking to one person sitting on the other side of that lens, either on their couch or, you know, in their living room or on their laptop, wherever. But you're playing to one or two people on their couch. That's the trick. And so you don't have to shoot it as far. You don't have to send it to the balcony of a performing arts center or, you know, even a 200, 300 seat club. I miss the back and forth because I do talk to the audience and get them going and then, you know, have a little fun with them and then slide into the next song. But I don't have that. So I pretend that the person that's sitting on that couch is listening and interested and that they think I'm funny. That's all you need, is a little positive push forward. And then you can roll through the show and kind of, you know, entertain them on their couch. And that's the trick. That's the trick. And it's been fun to do. Certainly the travel is a lot easier. You know, we're doing it from our recording studio here at home with my sons. And, you know, I'm making the best of it. You can get a little more intimate, you know, you can deep tracks, as they say, you can play some stuff that you might not play if there were 300 people expecting to be entertained. You know, you can trust that maybe they'll handle this 10-minute story about Lanford Wilson and how the Pulitzer Prize winner handed you a poem called Road Signs and it ended up being this song. You know, that you can go there and then play Road Signs. And if someone is truly interested in listening from their couch, they're still with you. So that the assumption is there, and versus the immediate feedback of yes, they are, or no, they aren't, or man, I'd really like to hear a funny song now. And you can kind of feel it. You don't have to paying attention to that. You can kind of do what you want to do.
And Rose Science is part of Jeff Daniels, who we're speaking to right now, his new album, Alive and Well Enough. Jeff, are you writing right now? I mean, you're playing, you said you were filming, you had to stop. Are you being as prolific of a writer as you've been before during this period of time?
I've been asked to write a couple of things, an essay for this or Nora Guthrie called. She's doing a book about Woody, and she's having a bunch of people write introductions to certain chapters. So I was really honored to be asked to do that. It's mostly guitar work at this point. Certainly playing all these live streams, there's nobody else. It's just me and the acoustic. And you try to make that acoustic sound like a whole orchestra, you know, the low, the middle, and the high, if you're finger picking. And so I've just been working on the next couple of musical ideas on the guitar that, of course, are far too complicated to play without practicing for 3 months. But I know they're good ones, so I'm going to stay at it. And that's kind of which is fun. That's a lot of fun for me, is to kind of, okay, here's a really good one that needs good lyrics, so don't just put anything on this. Meanwhile, try to learn how to play it. And that's kind of where I'm at.
And is this the same guitar from Herb David in Ann Arbor? Long gone Herb David, or are these new guitars that you're using?
I still have that. It was a Gil D40 that I bought for $400 out of Herb David in Ann Arbor, his guitar shop. And I bought a few of them from Herb. I still have it. It's not that guitar, but I still have it. It's hanging up.
I read something about during the pandemic, our dreams are getting weirder because we have less interactions like out in the world. Right. And so our brains are coming up with things that maybe we haven't thought about for a dozen years. I wonder, as an artist who is writing songs, where are you getting songs from if you're not out in the world? I mean, obviously, this latest album is political, so I assume you're getting it from Trump and D.C., just reading the lyrics. And there's some poetry in there, too. But what do you use for inspiration when you're on lockdown?
It is difficult because it's tricky. I'm not being very prolific right now, and I wonder if that's part of it. We're all dealing with the same thing. We're all in the same boat, and maybe that would be inspiring. So now you can write songs that everybody understands based on this thing that we're going through. Or there's nothing there. You're staring at a wall, you know, which is kind of what it feels like. So it's been tricky. I did write a little bit, and it was dealing with the pandemic, and then added some other songs that I thought fit the album. But I'm not writing anything new. Not quite sure why, but I'm not.
I think that's how a lot of folks are feeling right now.
Trying.
Before we let you go, I just want to ask, how is the Purple Rose Theater doing? You, of course, are the founder of this just magnificent theater in Chelsea. How's the theater holding up in the middle of the pandemic?
Well, we had a couple of really good years with the support from people for the theater and the box office. And so we were in a place where we could financially ride it out with a skeleton staff, which is what we're doing now, where we've retained the people that we're going to need to start over, basically. And it gives us a chance to kind of address some things that we want to do differently and just play selection, but also number of productions, and try to set the Purple Rose up so that it can live well beyond me and Guy Sandville. That it's time that we get ready to pass it on, and it needs to be in a place where it can sustain itself without having a celebrity at the top of it. And that'll be what we're doing when we come back is kind of reprogramming for that.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, and we're all sending our love to the Purple Rose Theater, who the co-founder is Jeff Daniels, actor and musician who is playing some virtual gigs, including one coming up this Friday night at the Midland Center for the Arts, and his new album, which I believe, if you're okay with it, I'm going to steal when anyone asks how you're doing during the pandemic. Just say Alive and Well Enough.
Plagiarism is the sincerest form of flattery. Steal away. Yes.
Jeff Daniels, thanks so much, man.
All right. Thank you, Zoe. Take care.
Support for arts and culture coverage on Stateside comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. And that's our show today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Zoe Clark, in for April Bear.